British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to an investigation that has led to claims of prisoners being warehoused in a system in crisis, the vast majority of prisons in England and Wales are providing inadequate conditions or unacceptable treatment. An analysis of hundreds of inspections found that three-quarters of prisons in England and Wales are now providing insufficient standards in at least one respect. More than a third were deemed to be insufficiently safe. On Saturday night, 6th of August, several senior figures warned that prisons were in the worst condition that they had known. The Chief Inspector of Prisons, the Tory Chair of the Justice Committee, and senior prison staff all warned that the findings had been fueled by overcrowding. The prison population stands at 86,763, with just 947 empty cells in England and Wales. However, insiders say that the supposedly spare cells were often in the wrong places or inappropriate for incoming prisoners. The news comes with instances of prison deaths, suicides, and serious assaults on inmates and staff alike. There has also been an alarming rise in the rates of self-harm in women's prisons, up 51% in the year to June. Andrea Olbart, president of the Prison Governors Association, called for an urgent early release scheme. Andrea Olbart said, "Recent policies designed to hand out tougher sentences together with crowded prisons, a backlog of remanded prisoners, and a smaller, inexperienced workforce meant it was now necessary." She said, "We are stuffed to the gunwales," adding, "We're doing little more than warehousing people. The result is that we're delivering really poor regimes in many of our prisons, with prisoners locked up for 22 hours a day. In a nutshell, it's dangerous." Andrea Olbart added, "This is absolutely the worst that I've ever seen. They have got to look at an early release scheme of some kind. It is very straightforward. The big thing to sort out the crisis that we've got is to reduce the population of prisoners by thousands." All prisons in Britain are inspected to see if they satisfy basic standards for safety, respect for prisoners, access to purposeful activities and rehabilitation. In each area, they are deemed as being good, reasonably good, insufficiently good or poor. The Guardian examined 245 full inspections covering 123 of the prisons in operation. The most recent inspections for each prison stated that 95 were poor or not sufficient in at least one area. Two-thirds were failing to provide adequate, purposeful activity for prisoners. Experts say it was a sign that prisons had failed to lift COVID measures that saw prisoners locked up for long periods of time. More than 40% of prisons recorded a worse score compared with their previous inspection. Just in the last fortnight, inspectors raised the alarm over the conditions in Bristol, now regarded as one of the unsafest prisons in the country. Eight men had killed themselves since the last inspection, while one had been charged with the murder of a cellmate. Emergency cell call bells often went unanswered, and the prison was found to be violent and riddled with drugs. Charlie Taylor, the chief inspector of prisons, told The Guardian, "These worrying findings correspond closely with those of our own annual report, published recently, and with the issues that led me to write to the Secretary of State issuing an urgent notification for improvement at Bristol Prison." Charlie Taylor added, "The situation in many institutions is concerning, and as population pressures compound this, we need to see resolute support from the Centre for Every Prison and every prison governor. We cannot allow a situation to persist where prisoners are simply warehoused in deteriorating conditions with the real risk of harm not only to them as individuals but also to the public if their rehabilitation has not been supported during their time in custody. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. Bob Neill, the Tory chief of the Justice Select Committee, said it is an extremely serious situation as we are looking at Britain's prison population, which could rise above 100,000 in the next 4 years. Bob Neill added, our own research shows that half of prison officers do not feel safe at work, and more than three quarters of those surveyed report that morale was not good. It all points to a high-pressure environment, and the government needs to set out what measures it is taking to address this wholly unacceptable situation, both in the short term and the long term. Nick Hardwick, the former Chief Inspector of Prisons, who is now Professor of Criminal Justice at Royal Holloway College, University of London, said prisons were in the most dangerous state I can remember. Nick Hardwick added, the increase is not just because we're sending more people to prison, but because we're sending people to prison for much longer. The taps are full on and the outflow is blocked. Campaigners called for the return of the end of custody license scheme. An early release program introduced by the Labour Party in 2007 to deal with overcrowding in prisons. It was abolished in 2010. Andrew Nielsen, director of campaigns at the Howard League for Penal Reform, said, today's government must recognise the gravity of the situation and look to a similar initiative if the prison system is to have any chance of recovery. Exclusive data obtained by The Independent from police forces in England and Wales revealed nearly 1,000 rapes were reported to have taken place in prisons since 2010. A further 2,336 sexual assaults were reported to police in the same period, and experts warn that the true figure for both crimes may be far higher because not all attacks would be reported. In response to The Independent's findings, Andrew Nielsen said, there has been minimal research and a worrying lack of coherent and consistently applied policies in relation to consensual and coercive sex behind bars. The investigation comes amid growing concern about the safety of prisons, both for those who are incarcerated and also for prison staff. Prisons face continuing issues with overcrowding, staff reductions and budget cuts, fueled by more than a decade of austerity measures from successive Conservative-led governments. According to research by Nasrul Ismail, a lecturer in criminology at Bristol University, the impact of security has left English prisons unable to provide safe environments for rising prison populations. Also, losing staff puts safety at risk. Andrew Nielsen stated that the Howard League had called for staff to be given more training and guidance, but we know that many experienced officers have since left the workforce and prisons have struggled to recruit and retain people to replace them. Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
In late August, BRICS leaders met for their annual summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. Perhaps the most significant moment of the summit came when Iran was introduced as a new member. a country that has been under the heaviest of sanctions in recent years, and a country the West claims to have been isolated both politically and economically. But why did Iran apply for BRICS? Why did BRICS agree to admit it? How can the economic bloc and Iran benefit from each other? And what messages has Tehran sent to its sworn enemies?
Whereas the West has been trying to downplay the role of BRICS in international arena, the facts on the ground are indicative of an emerging world order with a paradigm shift towards the global South. In addition to Iran, five other countries, such as Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, will officially join the group in January 2024. Meanwhile, 23 other countries have also applied for the membership. But why do these countries want to join the BRICS?
The acronym BRICS includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The bloc was founded as an informal club in 2009 to provide a platform for its members to challenge a world order dominated by Washington and its Western allies. Apart from geopolitics, BRICS' major focus is on economic cooperation and multilateral trade and development. The BRICS founding members hold several records. Russia, China, Brazil, and India are among the top seven biggest countries in the world. Three out of five largest armies belong to BRICS. China and India are two BRICS countries, each with a population of more than 1 billion. BRICS accounts for more than 40% of the world population, a quarter of the global economy, and one-third of the surface of the Earth. Among giants like China, Russia, and India, South Africa seems to be like a dwarf. But the fact is, the country is the second biggest economy in Africa and the sixth biggest country in terms of size and population in the continent. South Africa has also the third biggest army in Africa.
You know that all countries across the world are looking for political, economic, and military partners. Basically, it's impossible to solve your problems in the international arena without partners and allies.
This is Sayyid Mahmoud Reza Sajjadi, former Iranian ambassador to Moscow. Mr. Sajjadi said BRICS is in essence an alliance against U.S. unilateralism.
The BRICS nations, including Russia, China, India, Brazil, and South Africa, are among the most populated countries across the world with huge amounts of potential and capabilities. A decade ago or so, these countries decided to form a front against American unilateralism so as to clear hurdles on their way towards economic progress.
Mr. Sajjadi believes BRICS should be happy to have Iran in its camp as the country can increase the group's military prowess.
In what ways is Iran joining the BRICS significant and important?
Today, Iran is considered as a nation that has long stood up against the Western hegemony. It's regarded as the leader of the resistance movement. So I think that BRICS is happy to have the Islamic Republic on its side. I would like to say something here. A few days before Iran attacked Ain al-Assad, former US President Trump had warned that if the Iranians do something against the Americans, he would attack 51 areas of Iran. Iran attacked, but Trump did nothing in retaliation. This means we are not afraid of American threats at all. This military power has just joined the BRICS nations. In addition, Iran has a great population and economic potential. I think it's a good omen that Iran has joined BRICS.
With the recent expansions, BRICS, or BRICS Plus as some may call it, now accounts for almost 46% of the global population. Adding high population growth countries like Ethiopia means BRICS could soon represent over half the world's population. The global share of BRICS GDP will be 29%, while with the addition of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Iran, its oil production will make up for 43% of the world production. BRICS member states are among the biggest producers of goods and among the major exporters of raw materials. BRICS is also important in terms of having huge, different natural resources, including rare earth elements. For example, Argentina, a new member, is a major producer of lithium, a critical metal for the clean energy transition. Moreover, BRICS members are home to cheap labor, crucial for producing competitive commodities. This is Kambiz Mirkarimi, Vice Chairman of Iran-Russia Joint Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Mirkarimi told us BRICS will give the Islamic Republic an extra bargaining chip in the international arena.
Do you think that joining the BRICS would decrease or perhaps eliminate the impact of sanctions for Iran?
There is no doubt that the more economic alliances Iran joins, the more bargaining chips the country will have in the face of those who impose sanctions. Without economic leverage, you cannot gain much in negotiations with your enemies. Even when you are involved in negotiations with private sectors, there are times your talks come to a standstill. But with more power and presence in the world market, you can go ahead with fewer interruptions.
At the core of the BRICS lies a serious intention to alter the post-World War II order in favor of a multipolar world. Washington's addiction with financial sanctions and its warmongering and scant, if any, respect for the billions of lives in the global south are only some of the reasons for the growing disenchantment with the prevailing international system.
The former Iranian ambassador to Moscow believes that sanctions are no longer a cause for much concern.
Look, I see the matter this way. Today, we are no longer affected by sanctions, and with our own capabilities, we can sidestep sanctions. Now we have to figure out how we can help our 25 countries that are under sanctions. Today, things have changed for us. We are no longer afraid if we don't accede to FATF demands, if US sanctions are not going to be lifted. Once they told us that we would have to import water from abroad, but you know things have changed, and all these threats are now threadbare.
The Islamic Republic's entry to BRICS was a clear message from Tehran that the so-called crippling sanctions and maximum pressure have failed to isolate the Iranian nation. The main BRICS nations, that is Russia and China, which like Iran are under a slew of sanctions imposed by the U.S. camp, admitted Iran among the first new members, a success story which debunks the myth of Iran's isolation. BRICS leaders recently supported Iran's right to its peaceful nuclear program, hoping for a final agreement between Iran and the P5+1 group.
There are several certain positive perspectives through BRICS, and the first one I think basically relates to the fact that the world is experiencing an emergence of a new world order, and Iran is supposed to be compatible with this new world order. And considering the fact that in this new world order, we see a multipolar system.
To know more about this, we talked to Mr. Tohid Asadi, an Iranian political expert. To Mr. Asadi, the unsuccessful experience of the JCPOA, or the Iran nuclear deal, prompted the Raisi administration to look for economic solutions in non-Western alliances.
The truth of the matter is that getting into such alliances, such actually associations as BRICS, would certainly open up new fronts for the Iranian economy, which has been suffered from so many sanctions imposed on the country by Western and in particular the American economic system. And then the second point is that Iran is currently speaking, after President Raisi came to the office, opened a new front in its foreign policy agenda. Considering the fact that they spent more than a decade on talks with West, and the result of which was JCPOA signed and sealed back in 2015 as a UN Security Council resolution. But the result is that Regardless of all these attempts by Iran, we received almost nothing in return, regardless of our full commitment to the deal. So it provided a certain foreign policy perspective among not only Iranian political elites, but also among the public that this trajectory of putting trust with the West and talks with countries like the United States is not something that could serve the benefits of the country.
By supporting countries which have been under unfair sanctions imposed by the United States and its ilk, BRICS is in fact trying to make these economic pressures ineffectual. And this has unnerved the West.
Do you think that the U.S. is dissatisfied with the fact that Iran is going to join the BRICS Association?
I'm strongly convinced that emergence of such blocs and expansion of BRICS, Iran's entrance to BRICS, these are all indicative of the fact that the world is changing and the United States is not happy about this change, because it's just going to diminish the American hegemony over global economy, global politics, local politics even in some extent. And there are so many other instances clearly indicating this fact.
Following the annexation of Crimea by the Russian Federation in 2014, Moscow's trade interactions with the Group of Seven went down by 36%. That's while Russia's trade with the BRICS nations had 121% growth, without which the Russians would have experienced hard times. The Russia case has caused a great number of countries to consider BRICS as a way out of the West's clout. This has prompted even countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to join the group, despite their seemingly close ties with the West. That said, political advantages are not the only perks of the BRICS membership.
Welcome to the news section of the program, where we will go over some news excerpts from different news websites, starting with The Guardian. BRICS to more than double with admission of six new countries. From the beginning of next year, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Argentina, the UAE, and Ethiopia will join the current five members, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. China's President Xi Jinping described the expansion as historic. He had been the leading proponent of the admission of new members, presenting an enlarged BRICS as a way for the Global South to have a stronger voice in world affairs. According to The Guardian, the decision to admit Iran, also looking for a way to sidestep sanctions, represented a win for Putin and Xi, helping give the group a more anti-Western tinge. Middle East Eye has ran this headline. Iran, can the BRICS help Tehran break free from Western sanctions? Applying to join BRICS was viewed as a strategic decision by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's government. This government appears to take a pragmatic and realistic view of the economic potential of the BRICS bloc, rather than seeking to exploit this alliance for domestic political gains. According to the Middle East Eye, beyond the rhetoric, Iran has publicly backed the de-dollarization program of BRICS, aiming to develop its trade ties with the emerging powers of the Global South, while moving away from American dominance over the world's financial institutions. Continuing negotiations to remove or reduce Western sanctions, along with talks among BRICS members to create mechanisms and transparent rules for financial transactions, are essential prerequisites for Iran to convert BRICS into a flourishing platform to pursue its goals. According to Time magazine, BRICS asks Saudi, Iran, other nations to join to add heft. According to Time, major emerging market nations invited top oil exporter Saudi Arabia, Iran, Egypt, Argentina, Ethiopia, and the United Arab Emirates to join their bloc in a push to expand its global influence. An expanded BRICS would also mean more say for the alliance in world affairs and may lead to a different type of global economy, according to Bloomberg Economics. That's because in comparison to the group of seven, the BRICS are less market-oriented. This brings us to the end of this section. Please stay tuned as we go back to our main narrative. Since its foundation, BRICS has sought seriously to become a reliable financial and monetary institution and to serve a counterpart for other Western-dominated organizations such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. BRICS' new development bank has been founded for this purpose. The bank can help Iran and Russia, two countries that have been banned from major financial service providers such as the Belgium-based SWIFT.
This is Hassan Mahfouzi of the Muqawemati Economy Think Tank.
One of the main advantages for countries joining the BRICS, especially countries such as Iran that are under sanctions, is to receive banking services from the new development bank. Could you please explain more?
The new development bank, NDB, finances infrastructural projects. If you look at the projects for which the NDB has granted loans, you'll find out that the majority of these projects have to do with transportation infrastructure, transit of goods, and things like that. Then you'll see financial assistance urgently given to counter the COVID-19 pandemic. Then projects in the field of IT, social relations, school building, renewable energies, and the like, in various fields. And the BRICS countries, Iran included, need to invest in all these various fields. As the leader pointed out in his recent speech, we need foreign investment. The BRICS New Development Bank is one of the ways for foreign capital to enter the country.
Governments' desire to liberate themselves from reliance on the U.S. dollar is nothing new. Murmurs in foreign capitals to dethrone the dollar have been in the air since the 1960s. But they have never been serious until quite recently. This time, as Foreign Policy put it a few months ago, a BRICS currency could shake the dollar's dominance. Mr. Mahfouzi told us that in theory, de-dollarization is quite possible, though it might not happen overnight.
One of the aims of the BRICS countries is to expand trade in local currencies, thereby challenging the power of the dollar in international trade. To what extent do you think this objective and this aim is feasible and attainable?
Look, in bilateral agreements and bilateral trade interactions, you can bypass U.S. sanctions. You can define your own financial and business tools yourself. What Iran and Russia are doing right now, or what the two neighboring countries of India and Bangladesh are doing. In the case of India and Bangladesh, they came to the agreement to trade with their own national currencies and not through dollar-based systems. The question is, why are countries taking such de-dollarization measures? These countries know that if they call for their independence from the U.S. hegemony, they might face U.S. sanctions. As a result, they're trying to formulate their own financial systems free from the dominance of the dollar.
BRICS leaders have all been trying to shatter the dominance of the dollar with a BRICS-issued currency. The BRICS nations, at least on the scale of GDP, collectively outweigh not only the United States, but the entire G7 weight class put together. If the long-awaited de-dollarization happened, it would be a new lease of life for Iran. Mr. Asadi believes that the de-dollarization is not a mirage, something just out of reach, given a new understanding in the world economy.
Do you think that BRICS can challenge the existing world order, basically dominated by the U.S. and the West Bloc?
Just a couple of months ago, the Iranian president paid a visit to Indonesian capital, Jakarta, and there, the two countries agreed to use local currencies in their trade. Iran is under sanction, we all know about that, but Indonesia does not have that much problem, not like Iran's problems with the United States. But such a country is ready to jeopardize its economic situation, its ties with the West, to open up new front with Iran. There is this emerging understanding in Asia, in Africa, and elsewhere, in Latin America. and other parts of the world regarding this changing nature of world economy. And one of the first consequences out of this ongoing change is that we are going to observe less dollar, and we are going to see less hegemony of the United States and the West, and we are going to see a certainly multipolar system in the world.
Iran's membership in the BRICS is a win-win situation. The country lies at the heart of BRICS as it is situated at the crossroads of Europe, Asia, and Africa. It owns vast oil and gas resources and numerous mines. It also has a robust defense system and seeks to defend the security of the region and is also against the interference in regional affairs. All of these can help the BRICS alliance thrive.
Cheap, fast, and safe transition networks are of paramount importance to BRICS as a primarily economic group of nations. Iran, along with India and Russia, are already developing the International North-South Transport Corridor, a 7,200 kilometers long multi-mode network of ship, rail, and road routes for moving freight from India to Europe and vice versa, with Iran in the center.
And one of the important aspects of BRICS is a safe, cost-effective, and fast transit. What role do you think Iran would play in this regard?
Look, Iran and the Middle East in general are known for their great transit locations, situated between the East and the West. In this regard, Iran's location is quite prominent. We have access to free waters. We have direct access to dozens of countries around the Caspian Sea in the north and the Persian Gulf countries in the south. Part of the international north-south transport corridor passes through Iran. So does part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. So Iran is at the intersection of two important transit routes, the International North-South Transport Corridor and the Belt and Road Initiative.
Iran is an important link in China's Belt and Road Initiative, a global infrastructure development strategy adopted by Beijing in 2013. The world's factory can export its products to the Middle East and Europe through the shortest, cheapest, and safest routes that Iran can provide. On the other hand, the Asian Dragon can easily import its required raw materials from the Middle East, again through Iran. Moreover, Iran, along with Saudi Arabia, are among the top BRICS members that can meet the growing energy-related needs of the rest of the group. When all is said and done, BRICS is faced with its own challenges. The heterogeneous nature of the group, with different political systems and financial infrastructures which span across the five continents, make unity among its members a delicate and difficult task. For example, geopolitical disputes between China and India can spin out of control. Or some members may not agree with what Russia is doing in the Ukraine war. Or India and South Africa, as two BRICS members, are not willing to take an anti-Western pose. These are all tricky issues to deal with, and as a result have made BRICS a rather negative coalition of states that may not agree on a common position, but can create a consensus on what they oppose. Despite their differences, BRICS member states have made it clear that they all oppose sanctions, protectionist measures, and the post-World War II order. More and more countries are now shifting camps to the benefits of the emerging economies and powers that have proved so far to care more about developing nations by helping them survive and thrive.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Do tune in same time next week and each week after. Don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Till next time, take care.
Thank you.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
In the limelight.
According to a new poll, public confidence in the U.S. military continues to decline, reaching its lowest point in over two decades. Only 60% of Americans expressed a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the military in a recent Gallup poll conducted from June 1st to 22nd. That's down from 64% who said the same last year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, trust in the U.S. military itself is in decline, stemming from a variety of reasons and reflecting America's overall decline as a global superpower. Politico, in its recent article entitled "Americans' Confidence in the U.S. Military Lowest in Two Decades," poll finds, revealed that, regardless of political affiliation, be they Republicans, Democrats, or Independents, Americans view the U.S. military with far less trust than they have in over 20 years. The article notes that after 9/11 attacks in 2001, military confidence shot up and remained over 70% until declining beginning in 2021. This decline coincides with the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan that same year, which was seen as a debacle following two decades of what many Americans believed was an unsolvable quagmire. The poor performance of U.S. military planners and their civilian counterparts in withdrawing from Afghanistan led to the deaths of U.S. service members as well as Afghan civilians and left the nation in disarray. Less visible are the fates of tens of thousands of U.S. service members who were sent on multiple tours overseas to either Iraq or Afghanistan or both, suffered physical or mental trauma, and returned home only to find a system that put them on long waiting lists for inferior care or received no care at all. These men and women found civilian life difficult to adjust to after experiencing the surreal nature of combat and military occupation thousands of miles from home. These U.S. service members spent years of their lives away from their families and friends, fighting abroad for abstract concepts like freedom and democracy and to nation build, only to return home and see their own nation in steep decline. After contributing to foreign interventions abroad, which denied people from North Africa to Central Asia peace and prosperity, these U.S. service members likewise found the prospects of building a peaceful and prosperous life at home elusive. this has not been lost on the American people as a whole, who see their veterans neglected, mistreated, and forgotten about after fighting wars that more and more Americans neither ask for nor benefited from. Not only has public trust in the U.S. military declined, so has the U.S. military itself. The Wall Street Journal, in its article, The Military Recruiting Crisis, Even Veterans Don't Want Their Families to Join, noted a growing crisis facing U.S. military recruiters who are struggling to find qualified Americans who are both capable and willing to join the U.S. military even as standards are repeatedly lowered. Standards are lowered for two reasons: to attract more people who are otherwise unqualified to join the military, and to resolve the problem that each year the average American is less qualified for military service. This is due to factors such as drug abuse, obesity, criminal backgrounds, and poor education, which in turn lead to poor military entry test scores. America's decline feeds into all of these factors. And all of these factors contribute to America's decline as well as the U.S. military's decline. As the standards are lowered, the military itself, as an institution, becomes less attractive to the serious mindset that makes the ideal recruit. As less qualified recruits join the U.S. military and work their way up through the ranks, the military, as an institution, becomes less attractive still. It is a vicious cycle born out of the strain of America's endless wars spanning both the globe and the decades. The American people are losing trust in all of their institutions, including those they have historically trusted the most, such as the U.S. military. This loss of trust is not because the U.S. military itself is inherently untrustworthy, but rather because of what America's political leadership have used the military for and what they have done to the military as they used, abused, and exhausted it. These leaders, with poor performances, have sent Americans to fight and die overseas in pursuit of unsustainable global dominance, which has had negative repercussions on America's economy, education system, and society at home. The decline in these areas produces the conditions in which crime, disease, and ignorance thrive, depriving the military and the rest of American society of the qualified human resources necessary for survival and growth. Unless the fundamental problems of U.S. foreign and domestic policy are solved, the decline will persist, affecting not only the military, but also eroding the trust the American people have in it.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this episode, we invite you to listen to the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and Officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, on August 17, 2023, in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya. Treat other nations with justice and equitably, even if they do not have the same beliefs. Hatred of a people means, even if they are opposed to you, you should not be unfair when dealing with them. Well, the regimes whose actions are based on injustice are essentially opposed to the Islamic system. England was once the richest country in Europe. Where did it get its wealth from? From India, from the Indian subcontinent, and from the Americans when they were occupied by Britain. They gained their wealth by stealing the interests of others. France became a rich country. It was able to pursue scientific work. Where did it get its wealth from? From Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, and the French regions in Africa and Latin America. The rest were the same. The basis for carrying out their actions was exploitation. Since they knew how to sail and they were located by the sea, they were able to go everywhere. They initially did these things using trickery and deceptions, but when they obtained guns, they were able to forcefully seize the interests of other nations.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, it is clear that these governments, powers, and regimes are against a system that is based on standing against the oppression of nations and opposes interference in the affairs of other nations. That is how it is. And yet, you see some political analysts sitting around analyzing what the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic system, and the Islamic Republic have done that has caused certain countries to oppose it. Is an analysis even needed? It is obvious. This is the issue. The diabolic colonialist system is unable of being on good terms with a system such as the Islamic system. The next point is that the Islamic system believes in the dignity of human beings. Human beings because they are human beings, not just human beings who are of a certain region, race, or skin color. Indeed, we have honored the children of Adam. The Holy Quran, Surah 17, Ayah 70. This is what the Quran says.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
U.S. oil refineries are leaking cancer-causing benzene into residential neighborhoods of Gulf, South, and Midwest. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out wrote, dangerous concentrations of the cancer-causing chemical benzene are still being detected in the air and near ground level between oil refineries and neighboring communities in Gulf, South, and Midwest in the United States of America. The Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Inspector General, the federal watchdog for the EPA, released an alarming report recently exposing massive holes in regulatory efforts to track and require oil refineries to reduce harmful concentrations of benzene in the air, which overwhelmingly impacts low-income neighborhoods and communities of color that are already overburdened by industrial pollution. The EPA classifies benzene as a national cancer risk contributor alongside toxic pollutants such as acetaldehyde, carbon tetrachloride, and naphthalene. Unsurprisingly, many of the worst offenders are located in the industrial corridors of Louisiana and Texas, where the fossil fuel industry holds massive political sway. Environmental enforcement is sparse, and fiery explosions, deadly accidents, and pollution leaks at fossil fuel refiners and petrochemical plants are common occurrences that often result in evacuation orders for nearby residents. Using more recent benzene data from 2022 and 2023, the Environmental Integrity Project, an independent watchdog group, released a list of 12 oil refineries and petrochemical plants that rank among the worst benzene polluters. Between April 2022 and March 2023, air monitors around the facilities, 7 in Texas, 4 in Louisiana, and 1 in Iowa, detected benzene between the facilities and surrounding neighborhoods at levels above the public health limit, which is supposed to trigger fossil fuel companies to take cleanup action. Top polluters on the list include the Camlet Refinery in Camlet, Louisiana, and Total Energies Petrochemicals in Port Arthur, Texas, both located near residential areas known as environmental justice communities because they have long struggled with pollution on the outskirts of New Orleans and Houston, respectively. A refinery located in Clinton, Iowa, and operated by Dutch chemical giant Leondale Basel ranks 5th on the list. In 2021, the company agreed to reduce thousands of tons of air pollution under a settlement with the EPA and federal prosecutors. Eric Schaffer, a former EPA civil enforcement director who now leads the Environmental Integrity Project, said the EPA Inspector General report highlights an urgent need for the EPA to crack down on oil refineries that are repeatedly putting neighborhoods right down the street at risk. The EPA Inspector General report found a lack of follow-through at several oil refineries that continue to report elevated benzene levels despite creating cleanup plans, while data from other polluters went missing in apparent violation of the regulations. Under EPA rules, Refineries largely police themselves unless they violate pollution limits, setting up bins and monitors at the Fennec line and regularly reporting the data to the EPA. However, simply allowing benzene concentrations to exceed the public health limit is not a violation of the EPA rules. The EPA may only have a limited time to correct the benzene monitoring and cleanup program and make a meaningful reduction in pollution for residents living near the worst offenders. If former President Donald Trump or another Republican takes the White House in 2024, the EPA will likely see its budget slashed and leadership replaced by champions of industry. During his time in office, Donald Trump pushed for sweeping environmental deregulation and pledged to unleash the fossil fuel industry with little oversight. Like refineries, petrochemical plants are also a major source of benzene, and many are located in the Gulf South and the industrial corridors of other regions in the United States. The 2015 EPA rules focus on oil refineries, and the EPA did not create the same benzene regulations for all chemical plants. However, several Gulf South chemical plants are under court orders or consent decrees that require the companies to monitor and report benzene in the air and make efforts to protect nearby residents. The Office of Inspector General made 6 recommendations to the EPA, including that the agency issue guidance regarding what constitutes a violation of the regulations and a strategy on how to address refineries that do not reduce their benzene concentrations to or below the action level. They recommended that the agency investigate the gaps in the monitoring data that they identified in the report, as well as periodically review submitted data for such gaps in the future. According to Hill, an internal watchdog is calling on the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, to step up its actions to address emissions of cancer-causing benzene, saying that oil refineries have been releasing unsafe levels of the substance. The EPA has classified benzene, which can come from burning coal and oil, as a known human carcinogen. Refineries turn crude oil into gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. The Office of the EPA's Inspector General issued a new report recently saying that out of 25 refineries that had excess benzene emissions at least one time between January 2018 and September 2021, 23 had at least one other instance of excess emissions and 13 had at least 10 more instances. Furthermore, the report said that these 25 refineries, at least 18 later, emitted the chemical at levels that present health risks.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.